Good evening and welcome to this Writers at Warwick event. I'd just like to begin by saying a few words about the writers we have with us this evening. The first to read will be Jo Shapcott, who, as Sean O'Brien states, is gifted and original, and it is in works such as hers that the future health of poetry needs to be sought. Indeed, Jo Shapcott has received deserved success, which includes the remarkable commendation of having won the National Poetry Competition twice. Jo has edited various anthologies, as well as publishing her own collections, including Electroplating the Baby, Phrase Book, and her latest book, Tender Taxes, an ambitious interpretation of a series of poems by Rilke in terms of her own personal experience. These are just a few, and in addition to her poetic success, Jo is generally a very accomplished person. She has studied music and singing at the Dublin College of Music, has a diploma in adults and community education, and has worked as the education officer for the South Bank Centre and for the Arts Council of Great Britain. She also appears regularly on BBC Radio 3 and 4, on Channel 4's Rhyme and Reason, and on BBC 2's Omnibus. Another facet to Jo's career is her dedication to teaching creative writing, running sessions for the Arvin Foundation, the Poetry Society, and at Cambridge. She has travelled widely as a guest writer and speaker, attending events like the Harbourfront International Festival in Canada and the Rotterdam International Festival. Jo certainly has a very energetic career, which is reflected in her poetry, since, as Michael Horowitz states, her poems have a way of turning physics into the physical. We also have Simon Ray reading for us tonight, who has also won the National Poetry Prize and has presented a wide range of BBC radio programmes, including Poetry Please. He is an eminent editor for the publishers Faber and Faber, having formulated such anthologies as News That Stays in News, The 20th Century in Verse, The Faber Book of Murder, and It's Not Cricket. His passion for cricket that made him poet in residence at Warwickshire County Cricket Club also inspired him to write the definitive, if radical, biography of W.G. Grace. His satirical poems have regularly appeared in The Guardian, and he has published a number of collections including Soft Targets, Thatcher's Inferno, Rapid Response, and his latest collection, The Face of War. Also, his first stage play, A Quiet Night, was performed in Bristol and London in 1999. Simon Ray is also dedicated to education and is now a Royal Literary Fund Fellow on the Warwick Writing Programme. Like Jo Shapcott, Simon Ray has a great deal of diversity in his writing and his career, and they both promise to give very lively readings this evening. So I think now I'll hand you over to Jo Shapcott and Simon Ray, and of course Jo will be reading first.
Thank you for the lovely introduction. Zoe knows more about me than I do. It's very unnerving. And thank you for inviting me to come this evening. At the moment, I spend most of my time on the Welsh borders, where I live in a little village called Gladestree. And I've written some poems about that place, collected together as the Gladestree Quatrains. I'm going to start by reading some of those, and most of them have a title that's also a place name, and a mixture, of course, because it's borders of Welsh and English. Gwaithla Brook. I'm always cladding myself in what's just undressed me. My body's a laugh, every cell a round, rude wavelet. So I change my outfit, even my long hair, my skin. Behind this kind of flight, my life ripples, totally see-through. Radnorshire. You'd be arrested, stopped halfway between earth and sky, caught drunk in charge on voices of water, bronze, beer, wrong-footed on a slick of oil, if you didn't warm your hands on this border country, touch its crust, finished like bread. Hunter Hill. Tiny rows of light, a wall crumbling in on itself, the slopes of the hill or of my cheek hesitate while the excess of light stamps its feet in the lane, all over me, insisting on the wrong route. Huntington Castle. Borders have castles which have forgotten whatever passion drove them to rise, though this one glances at me with the old look. Ivy forces into bluestone turrets, which a terrible sun makes gold when it's not glinting behind arrow slits through which the verbals peer. Gwaithla Road. It's absent-minded, full of sheep and mud, this lane, and beautiful light goldsmiths would want to set into stone. The rowan, in its exact place, opposes a vertical against the slow, robust field, which stretches itself and yawns. Kefineer. Do you see up there those high pastures of angels among the heather? In the strange light, they seem more than far. Down the clear valley and right up to the ridge, you can see yourself break into fragments which float in the air. Bird, mite, balloon, bat, RAF hawk. Glascombe. This slope has wings, as do our bats, and the dragonflies, and every bird flaunting as if resting on updrafts could make a creature invisible. Look, the light doesn't lie heavy on us at all. We can move our legs and arms through the honey, and even the grass wears its worms with grace. Culver. How old is the grass I'm standing on, or the earth where it's rooted? Younger than my computer icons for email, sky, wind, trash, and bread. Yesterday's still propagating in my body cells, in my synapses, and on the contours of this land underfoot, which consents much more easily to it. Katie Trilow. Before you can count to 10, everything changes. The wind flicks clarity out of even the high thistle stalks and flings it in my face, so close it can't be seen. A precipice on a border mountain gives more certain footing than this spot, where long grass displaces itself overnight, in wind, in rain, lies down under the clear air, as if stroked by the hand which made it up. Rilke spotted above Gilwern. Honeysuckle launches out of a hedge, tangled with bindweed, flowers alert, tongues hanging out for the moment to close. You're walking up the lane towards me with a bouquet of red berries from the hedgerow. Already? Is summer over? Another step closer and you'll have autumn for a lover. Road not available. You know how a man speaking about his mother suddenly looks like her, mid-sentence, right there. The fields above the stream often take to gurning their parents like that, endless remembering in which they drink their pasts further and further down, while the hill looks over its shoulder and seems to start back into pure space, returning like the pasture, to the astonishment of its origin. Born off. I'm amazed the earth hereabouts lets me breathe its atmosphere, that the voices I hear permit me to listen. When a word soars, such flight through these distances, you'd need some voice to take its measure. Over the Col. The wind speaks to the land like a linguist who's known its old word for ages. She finds the contours hot to touch, but understands just how to say them. She's unstoppable. In a burst of elan, she's likely to force out of me an enormous step backwards to put me in my place. Why marches? It keeps evading me, this border country, though my own grandfathers mined coal, coughed, spat, and died not far away. You round a corner and the hill has moved, the sky's gone AWOL, and the ancestors, muttering in another tongue, have dug themselves even further in. Clan. If there's a goddess of this place, does she speak Welsh? There's not much English in her bright face. Old border tongues trash this coom, words and sounds I can make when my parents rarely let me eat their ashes. The valley loves, it sleeps. Why should I enter its body, travel its capillaries, listen to its skin? Gwaithla Garden. It's like you to spot the small butterfly near the ground, showing off the illustrations in its flying manual, and to describe it like that, and the other one closing in on the edge of the flower we're all breathing now, because you wrote it in 1922, and oh, beloved, this is not the moment to read you into it, but to see the fragile blues scattered, floating and flying like the blue upstrokes and downstrokes of this torn-up love letter in the wind I've been writing you for ages while the postman hovered for it at the door. Mountain ash. The midges are drawing blood already, out early tonight. They're full up on me, round and wise like the children of a walnut. I'm complaining as loudly as the rowan, which is so cankered it must surely feel pain, though you could imagine the spaces between contain enough blue for healing. Down the track there's movement, a head bobbing through the greenery, my daughter wearing her red baseball cap, a dot offered to the tip of every eye. And now moving away from Gladestree, a poem called The Third Lie. I haven't explained myself. You close your eyes, you leap. It's almost a devout thing to do, or so God says, or another trap. Opening your eyes later, you get remorse like a joke. Stood next to such a gorgeous lie, you're in danger of looking fake. I'm going to read some poems which are inspired by two things. One is flowers. These are all roses of different kinds. They're also inspired by some poems the German poet Rilke wrote about roses. And I looked at his, and they were very declarative poems, I think to a woman or a number of women. And in them he says things like, "Rose, you are like this, you are like this," always addressing them and always seeming very certain about what they were about. My roses, who are also women, talk back. They have the voice, so it's the I voice, the I is the rose, often correcting him because it's not like that, it's like this. His were love poems. And I think, in the end, mine are too, and possibly love poems to Rilke himself. Each poem has the botanical name of a different kind of rose. I need to get a slideshow to go with this. Rosa Gallica. If sometimes you're surprised by my coolness, it's because inside myself, petal against petal, I'm asleep. I've been completely awake while my heart dozed for who knows how long, speaking aphids and bees to you in silence, speaking English through a French mouth. Rosa hemispherica. You see me as half open, a book whose pages can be turned by the wind, then read with your eyes closed. Butterflies stream out, stunned to discover they think just like you, dab wings all over your face. Rosa fetida. I'm an imperfect thing, neat, layered, but spilling petals and pollen, dropping bruised scent onto the ground. Essence of roses is not sweet, but brown at the edges like the air you breathe. Rosa centifolia. So you think you caused the bud to bloom, enchanted the petals into smiling. We're talking Rosa centifolia, the 100-petaled rose. Ask the bee, who can't concentrate on anything else. Rosa nitida. Space folds against space, petal touches petal. You look at me as though you want to fall in, make the flower glow with your own image, change my meaning from rose to narcissus. Rosa pimplefolia. Oh, I'm leaning against your forehead, against your eyelid, scenting your skin with my own, making you think you can sleep inside my face. Rosa sancta. Now you've made a saint out of me, Saint Rose, open-handed, she who smells of God naked. But for myself, I've learned to love the whiff of mildew, because, though not Eve exactly, yes, I stink of the fall. Rosa sempervirens. I've only a few hours of openness, so little time to exude caresses, float them in the air. If you forget what was this scent that drenched you, I'll die, but be forced back to work on miracles. Rosa damascena. You're inclined to confuse me with yourself, as if you'd found a mirror to worship. I'm guilty too, breathing you in to catch a trace of twice-blooming damask. Rosa canina. Look, I'm growing out of your left eye, snagging your retina with little thorns, rooting behind your frontal lobes. What can you see through the 100 pink tongues? Now you've a pupil who speaks perfume, attracts bees. Rosa mutabilis. I have vanished. The table set for food, wine glasses, the odd petal among this stuff. I know a gesture for every vase. I'm the same phrase, only now not sung. Rosa foliosa. You touch me with everything that's touched you. Pages and pages of past butterflies stroke me, moaning like the dictionary under the weight of it all. And I tremble, stupid, hybrid, perpetual, as I let you read me better. Rosa stellata. Perhaps we share the same subtle matter now I've stroked roots under your skin. It isn't work, you know, this opening and closing, but I can distract even God into choosing your house. Rosa terracantha. Spinning in the wind, so fast, even the thrips, my little petal-scarring insects, fly off dizzy. So fast you can't touch me without risking a thorn. Can only watch as my heart is shaken out into the world. Rosa mundi. Oh God, here I stand, feet in my own grave, smiling, lifting your face in my own hands. I turn you to the sun and hold you there, waiting to see what will open in the light. I'm going to finish with a poem called The Fifth Lie. Telling lies seems easy for you, angel. You're the road, even when stood still. So lend me a hand here. Be a pal while we hunt down together what was real. Hunter or hunted, remember this first. She, the one surfacing, will be different. Too much music hurts my skin. Different from the man who dived in. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. And now Simon Ray.
There was an old not the 9 o'clock news joke, which I'm sort of reenacting, wasn't there? Rowan Atkinson in his leathers, standing in the loo, wondering which zip contained what he was looking for. I know it's all in here somewhere. And indeed it is. I'm afraid I've reached the stage when I have to change glasses for almost every activity. I'm going to start with a short little poem called The Ballpark Figure, which goes like this. Imagine a ballpark with a figure in it. This is the ballpark figure. Figure out this figure's power to mark the tight parameters of your desires, to take your life and pin it to a wall, a graph of limited possibility. Then train your eye along the barrel of a gun. Squeeze lightly. This is the big one. I'm going to move on to a poem which I think I understand a bit better than that. I was very lucky several years ago to live briefly, but very happily, at Garsington Manor, which, as many of you will be aware, was the place that Lady Ottilyn Murrell made a sanctuary for the Bloomsbury Group and conscientious objectors during the First World War. In fact, I was living in a flat that Frieda Lawrence had turned down as not having enough amenities for her and DH, though I think there had been an improvement in the heating over the intervening decade. It was a fantastic place to live, but obviously rather inhibiting as a writer. But the beauty made up for the fact that I spent a lot of time looking at a blank manuscript book, wishing I could write something. I suspect I probably wrote this after I left. The gardens at Garsington are simply wonderful, and in the middle of them is an ornamental lake, which comes into this poem, which is called Jumping in the Lake. One afternoon, when the fashionable objectors were gathered under the ilex tree, the Prime Minister was announced. He was just in time for tea. Almost immediately, one of the maids was reported drowning in the lake. A smartly suited private secretary jumped smartly in, expecting, no doubt, a heroic flood up to his chin, but found himself standing in about 3'6" of muddy pond water. The maid in her parachutes was within easy reach, but obviously safe. Her hysterics masked laughter, he suspected, and judging from the hoots of Bloomsbury merriment from the lawn, there had never been the slightest danger. Later in the war, when the cowmen went in, there was no Prime Minister's private secretary, and no mistake. He knew the hull-shaped channel to the deepest part, and slogged on down with a brick in each jacket pocket and a sack of horseshoes clutched to his heart. Many years later, I was living in a less salubrious spot, viz. Hackney, which I also liked for different reasons. And I started a sequence called Hackney Passables. This is the first of them, and it's called Bananas. Our grocer is a government in waiting, with a bullet hole to prove it. A botched contract job as he was shutting up one night, the bullet passed through both plate glass and ribcage, like a presidential motorcade tearing through slums on the way to the airport, and a meeting with money. He was back within days, cheerful as ever, and perfectly happy to unbutton his shirt for an inner cabinet of loyal admirers. He bags my mushrooms with a deft twist, weighs them with an eye unblinking as justice. The till rings like the bell on the bus, threading its way through the tower blocks, another stop en route to the day of retribution, when he'll string up his enemies like a bunch of his own blackening bananas. The torturer's breakfast consists of freshly squeezed orange juice, thinly sliced ham, and some grated Parmesan cheese. He is tired. His work is hard. He has been at it all night under the bare bulb that hurts his eyes. He's underrated. No appreciation of his subtlety, his intuitive sense of when to ease off and when to go on through the screaming. His marriage is on the rocks. His hours are unsocial. His lovemaking apologetic. He suspects an irrational jealousy of all the other flesh that passes through his hands. She says she can't talk to her friends. Think of the pay, he urges. The pay, she shouts back at him, hardly covers the laundry. One of the most difficult, if not the most difficult, commissions that I've had was to write some poems to go with some cartoons by that great cartoonist Ronald Searle, best known in this country, I think, for his St. Trinian Girls and How to Be Top, etc., etc. He left England perhaps 20 years ago and has lived in France ever since, and he's done a lot of more political cartoon work over there. And as those of you who are familiar with his work will know, he doesn't leave much room for a wordsmith. However, I was intrigued by the challenge and did write some poems which sit with some of these fantastic cartoons. I should have a... Like Joe, we both need overhead projectors for our sets, but I'll describe this. It's a picture, clearly, of Saddam Hussein with an ominous grin on his face, large sword, and he's surrounded by what, if I took these off, might look like butterflies, but with them on, are clearly arms and ears and other things like that. And this poem is called Audience. On the comfortably swelling knoll of khaki rest the originals of the executioner's hands that hold above the bowed head of the city the giant crossed scimitars. The surprise of a face suddenly not two stories tall, bristling with eerie affability. Behind the eyes, a depopulated landscape scavenged by winds. A deserted platform piled high with unspeakable luggage, crudely roped trunks, seeping suitcases. His laugh is the clang of a tailgate, releasing an apple avalanche of boots. His handshake, intimate, crushing, like a bear's rotten-breathed embrace. Right, I think I might lighten the plane a bit. This next poem is called Cavalier, which You won't need me to remind you. It's also the name of a make of a car. Shit, shave and shower. Socks, shirt, suit. The rubber stamp of a kiss on a forehead for once not furrowed with being lied to. Then the burglar's exit to the getaway car. Over 16 sleeping policemen, through 4 sets of lights taken on amber, and onto the slip roads welcoming camber. All day he is aimed, a metallic sperm, in the fast lane's teeming slipstream. Valhalla'd by his stereo, he steers a course for death or glory, contemptuous of speed cop or camera. Trapped twice and docked plenty, he was woken once by a lollipop lady who appeared like a saint with an arresting halo after a heavy lunch and an overlong crocodile. His own he dialed daily and at night crashed into the airbag of sex. He favoured the finger over the horn, would swerve for dogs but flattened cats, and pursued a vendetta against vans and Volvos and anyone, anywhere, driving a Porsche. On the day it happened, his conscience was clear and his fingernails clean. It came from left field, the notorious blind spot to the right of the windscreen. A flying bomb of zips and chains, an airborne Harley engaged on a one-off, unsponsored stunt that scalped the car and stunned his oath in the stump of his throat. He blocked 2 lanes for an hour and a half, won some overtime for his friends in blue, and attracted the attention of a camera crew, but missed the 6 by a matter of seconds. By 10, a hostage had been shot, a tot found on waste ground, a prince spotted. So that, in the end, was as close as he got. This is another portrait, I suppose you could call it. And it's called Local. The cigarette disappears in the cave of his palm. That's his bar stool you're sitting on. But the grizzly bear arm doesn't reach out and fling you aside like a laundry bag or a sack of straw. Instead, he waves a permissive paw on which he's inscribed the usual half of the usual stuff about love and hate and his name twice and settles down to the evening shift in which he'll shift a pint per stone to the tune of 20. His belly gently rising and falling like a broad-beamed tug at ease at its mooring. He's a big man, and it's worth reflecting he doesn't need you to remind him of it by coolly inspecting the barroom floor or the stippled ceiling like a claims assessor after a fire supposedly caused by faulty wiring. But don't overdo it by staring too hard at the bridge of his nose, untidily scarred in a brush with the sleeve of a broken glass, or the sole of a boot stirruped with steel. His breath feels hot in the hair of your nape. He's used to being a chicken neck snap from a serious charge, but a man who could break the back of a horse with a trampoline bounce or shift an upright into the street via the open window without raising a sweat has nothing to prove, and you're no threat. You're his friend, his companion in arms, so enjoy the joke, but don't laugh too loud and don't try to cap it. Stay one of the crowd, a crowd of one, and you won't regret it. A word to the wise, there's a thin line and a golden rule for the likes of you with the likes of him. It's something to do with a weather vane whim and the perception of status. Airs and graces are usually surplus to any requirements. There's a lot of brunt that you'd have to bear as a la-di-da cunt if it came to that. But don't pretend, on the other hand, to be what you're not. It's a delicate balance, and what you risk is the weighty opinion of a ring-heavy fist, a tear gas salad of finely chopped onion served on the edge of the nearest table, and a ketchup spore zigzagging its way all the way from the bar. to the taproom door. Now, from time to time, poets, I'm sure, Joe has many more requests in this area than I do, poets get asked for a poem for an anthology, and that's always very flattering, and one sends what one has off and waits, not with bated breath, but in due course the book comes back with your contribution in it. And I was asked some time ago to contribute to a book of short poems. You may be wondering, on the strength of the reading so far, whether I ever write short poems, but the answer is I do from time to time, and I had a short poem and I sent it off. I was intrigued, not so astonished, when it came back in the big book of little poems, which on closer inspection was clearly aimed at a juvenile market. I can read you the poem I sent and leave its appropriateness to you to decide. It's called The Lane. Two cars graze together up a grassy lane. A couple of farmers inspecting crops or stock. Possibly, except it's already dusk and threatening rain, and one of the cars begins gently to rock. Well, perhaps they thought it was about cows, because there's some very pretty cows in the illustration underneath there. So anyway, apologies, by the way, to any unsuspecting parent who found himself reading that out in the nursery. Right. Now, this brings me on to another point of contact with Joe, which is our mutual friend Matthew Sweeney, because the next poem owes its existence to a poem of Matthew's, which actually I was very happy and proud to publish in a little pamphlet in a series that I was editor of. It's a very typical Matthew Sweeney piece with lots of sort of intriguing trails leading off to wherever your imagination wants to pursue them. On this occasion, I actually did pursue one of them. And so this is called a companion piece, The Penis in the Field. And it starts with four lines that I've nicked from Matthew's poem, In a Field. When the farmer, taking a shortcut home, comes across it, will he know what it is? Will he pick it up in a hanky and accelerate to the police? I knew exactly what it was, though I was surprised to see it just there by the kissing gate. The kissing gate you can in fact just see from the combine's cabin as you turn at the top of the 9 acre. And I did wrap it up in my handkerchief, but not to show the police. No, what formal identification there was took place at home on the kitchen table before I threw it into the pail for the pigs and slammed the door on the screaming to check that the knife, at least, with its nicked blade and string-bound handle, was still where I'd put it, 6 inches under the dirt under the hen coop. So, you can't be too careful, which is very much the line that the protagonists of this next piece took, with hilariously inept results. The spies were meant to meet at noon. They met at 4. They'd missed each other at the fallback too, and now met quite by chance in the main square, mad as hell. The row was loud and long and personal, attracting an appreciative crowd. The perfect cover. The spies had to talk urgently and at length. The queues outside their respective telephone boxes snaked back along the pavement and met at the corner. The spies mistrusted language, preferring things to passwords. Two handkerchiefs waved, shoe met shoe, and glove matched glove. Once, in a variation of stone, paper, scissors, a velveteen stole was capped by a pair of black knickers. The lie came up for auction. It was a whopper, and authenticated by a dozen expert witnesses. Both the spies bid for it, forcing the price up and up, until it was beyond the reach of either of them. The spies decided to get married. They changed their names by deed poll and sent out invitations in code to the wedding breakfast in a safe house recently demolished down the Balls Pond Road. This is a sonnet called Traveller. And it's about, that's obvious what it's about, really. But when you couple the talent for insomnia with jet lag, you do get something fairly sort of epic. He's tired beyond endurance from the flight, but finds his mind's a wobbling gyroscope that wants to, but won't quite, topple. Time's sleight of hand has locked his body clock inside a trunk and drowned it fathoms deep, and he's Houdini, straitjacketed on deck, condemned to drift forever through the night. The mosquito whine of consciousness climbs its octave. He tries his paperback again. The print panics like cockroaches exposed in a torch beam. He kills the light. The stain it leaves on darkness once his eyes are closed throbs like a lurid test card. So Magritte's slow, steady shower of unremitting suits. Now, Philip Larkin famously said that he wouldn't mind going to China if he could come back the same day. And as an equally great non-traveller, I had a similar approach to these matters, but I did actually get to China, at least the last bit of it, under the Union Jack. I went to Hong Kong in 1997, and wrote this about it. It was literally weeks, months, certainly a very short time before the handover. There was a sense of history waiting in the wings. Island of a million mouths and one desire, which gobbles every inch of sky. In plastic tanks along the pavements, lunch waits patiently to die. Shafts of sunlight mask from view, alleys meters from the street, where life is rapidly stripped down to fur, fat, offal, bones and meat. On every square foot steps a foot. Via elevated walkways, crowds surge and disperse like time-lapse sequences of clouds. The traffic winds down shadowed canyons. Trams are wobbly sardine tins bobbing on a brackish tide of mopeds, bicycles and limousines. Drains exhale the ghosts of cholera, wrapping a clammy towel around the face. The stranger, invisible but in the way, knows he could vanish without trace. The medieval mocks the modern. Bamboo scaffolding scales concrete cliffs. Inside, immaculate executives ascend in air-conditioned lifts. The calendar hands out dates like parking tickets. No one cares. Nothing can disturb an ingrained faith in fortune-tellers and self-made millionaires. The comic opera of the noonday gun is worthy of the doily cart. Those with only photographs to take them and depart. Oh, yes. This is a poem, again self-explanatory really, but it's one of the, I suspect, an ongoing series of poems that I started writing sometime after my father died. It's called Chaser. The bar begins to fill with lunchtime regulars. Veterans of wars and marriages, they bare their broken blood vessels, expanding waistlines, thinning scalps, and tufty ears with a stolid survivor's dignity. They slap their pockets, smokers to a man, and palm-cupped campfires lift a blue-grey haze to set a boundary to the afternoon's horizon. My shout, another scotch, another pint. I push my way through a wardrobe of tweed and cavalry twill and catch the barman's eye. Behind me the gent's door slams unheeded. I look back to where two stools are drawn companionably close, willing the skeins of smoke to form at least the semblance of a ghost. I know, of course, that you're not going to show, but where's the harm in wishing that you might? One pint, one scotch, many happy returns. I wave the change away to cancer research and toss your teachers down my throat. It burns. This is another short four-line little poem with a very self-explanatory title, Late Fatherhood. I see a lot of you in him, they say, smiling up from the crib. And so do I. Each day brings on the bald puce clubman in his bib. I'm going to finish with a couple of poems which also relatively short. This one is called Museum, and refers to a time I'm very happy to say is firmly in the past now, but one of the things about depression is that you have sort of lucid moments where you can see that it is all going to end, but a room in a museum, thick with dust and silence. There's my desk. The letters from friends to whom I once replied, but now make no pretense of keeping up with. The desperate junk mail parading a whole earth catalogue of despair, competing with bills and review books I fail even to open, all just lying there. Someone regularly fills the ashtrays and services the bin-cum-bottle bank, curators working in discreet relays, preserving the illusion time might pass. The lit space aches like a dry fish tank. I doodle in my own breath on the glass. And this last one is called Believed. And it goes like this. There's a missing person in everyone. A draft dodger, truant, man on the run, deserter, defaulter, garden fence vaulter, and into the wide blue yonder absconder. And I found mine, or he found me, and together we sauntered out for a paper or a carton of milk that wasn't needed to match the one that would turn to cheese while the cheese beside it turned slowly green, leaving the bed unmade and the garden unseeded and a bit of a mystery to explain. The wagging tongues went worrying back to the gap in the hedge and the hole in the fence, and to how they'd somehow always suspected there was more to the case than met the eye, and if only they'd known as they walked the dog or pushed the buggy round the block that that was the definitive last good evening. It would have been easier making sense of what they now saw was a chain of events. Meanwhile, smoke rings float to the ceiling, prompting this out-of-body sensation that I'm looking down on a pile of clothing artistically folded there on the shingle, and thinking how I'd left my life like a field of snow, which a confident witness would swear blind he'd seen me cross, yet find, when he came to prove his point, no tracks to show in the unblemished whiteness.